We'll discuss some of the CIA's top successes and failures in the fight against terrorism. And we'll examine the current threat from ISIS. A threat our guest says, if not addressed properly, could result in attacks against the U.S. that would dwarf 9/11. Good morning, I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8.5 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Friday, May 15th. Our guest is former CIA Deputy Director Michael Morrell, author of The Great War of Our Time, The CIA's Fight Against Terrorism from Al-Qaeda to ISIS. And we will welcome your questions for him and your views. Do you think the U.S. is handling this threat adequately? Do you think the threat is exaggerated? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let me welcome our guest. Michael Morrell is a 33-year Central Intelligence Agency veteran. He served as deputy director from 2010 to 2013 and two stints as acting director during that time. He's now CBS News' senior security correspondent. His book, The Great War of Our Time, The CIA's Fight Against Terrorism from Al-Qaeda to ISIS, was released this week. He joins us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Good morning.
Joy, good morning. It's great to be with you.
Why do you say terrorism is the great war of our time?
Because, Joy, it's an ideological struggle. It's not that different from the ideological struggle with the Soviet Union during the Cold War. I also call it the Great War because this is a war in my mind that is going to go on for quite some time. I say in the book that I believe that my children's generation and my grandchildren's generation is still going to be fighting this fight.
Yeah, you we saw this in USA Today, if we don't get ISIS under control, we are going to see that kind of attack, the kind of attack with mass casualties that Al-Qaeda launched on 9/11. So far, you say U.S. efforts haven't been effective in countering the Islamic State's success in recruiting hundreds of American converts, and were not effective because it's very hard to do. So let's break that down a little bit. You fear that we are going to have a 9/11 type attack, if not worse, if we don't address ISIS properly?
Yeah, Joy, let me just broaden that out a little bit. We have both ISIS and we have Al-Qaeda. I actually kind of lump them all together and call them Islamic extremists. They all have the same objective, which is to establish a global caliphate, and they both plan, want to attack the United States because they see that as critical to obtaining their objective. So really, in the book, I look at both the remnants of Al-Qaeda, which are quite strong today, as well as ISIS. And if you look at the threat to the homeland today, the threat is actually greater from some of the Al-Qaeda groups than it is from ISIS. So the threat to the homeland from Al-Qaeda in Yemen is very significant. The threat to the homeland from a group called the Khorasan Group, which is part of al-Nusra, which is an al-Qaeda group in Syria, is very significant. And despite the success we've had against them, and it's been quite significant, we still face a threat to the homeland from the original al-Qaeda group, which is in the border areas of Pakistan and Afghanistan. And that threat from those al-Qaeda groups today is significant in that I believe that each of those groups would be capable of carrying off not a 9/11 style attack, but a smaller attack such as bringing down an airliner. And I don't want to diminish that. I mean, that would be very, very significant. But all three of those groups have that capability. Now, when it comes to ISIS, they don't have the capability today to direct an attack against the homeland. What they're doing today is they are radicalizing young men and young women in the United States conduct attacks on their own. We've now seen two of those. We've seen an attack in Brooklyn against two New York City police officers by a guy with a hatchet inspired by ISIS. And just last week, we saw an attack in Texas, an attempted attack in Texas by individuals inspired. My point about ISIS in the long term is that if they're allowed to have safe haven in Syria and in Iraq over the long term, they will be able to develop a capability to attack us. And they will be able to develop a capability to attack us in a very sophisticated 9/11 style way. And they've also talked about, and this has been missed by many, many people, they've talked about an interest in weapons of mass destruction. And we really haven't seen that kind of talk since bin Laden talked about that prior to and just after 9/11.
Yeah. Talking about the recruiting, that just brought to mind that just recently a Wisconsin man pleaded guilty to a federal charge that he tried to join the Islamic State terror group. Why is this happening? How is ISIS finding success like this, convincing a man living in Madison, Wisconsin, that he wants to join their terror?
So they have two advantages in their propaganda. One advantage is they have a very powerful narrative, and their narrative is essentially that the West, the United States, the modern world is a threat to their religion, that we are trying to destroy their religion, and that's a very powerful narrative if you are a young Muslim. And the other part of that narrative is that we are in Iraq and we are in Syria and we are attacking them, and because of that, people need to stand up and attack us. So that's one part of their narrative that sells with young people around the world. And the other part is that they've got Madison Avenue quality social media. Some of the most sophisticated and polished social media that I've seen from a terrorist group. And that is because of the large number of Westerners, several thousand West Europeans, several hundred Americans, several hundred Canadians, several hundred Australians who have traveled to Iraq and Syria to fight for ISIS, and they have brought with them these IT skills. They have brought with them skills in social media, and they are using those very effectively with that narrative that I talked about to get into the minds of young Muslims in the West, including the United States.
So why is it so hard for us to counter those recruiting efforts? What should we be doing?
So I think there's really there's a whole number of things we need to do. And the first point I'd make is that dealing with the narrative itself is very, very hard. You can take down these sites that they're using, these servers that they're using to push out their message, but as soon as you take it down in one place, it pops back up in another place. So they just move from one server to another. So it's very hard to shut the messaging down. I think the other thing that's hard is that they're essentially putting out a religious message, and we don't have any credibility in talking about that message. We don't have any credibility pushing back on that. We don't have any credibility in the Muslim world talking about their religion. So we really need to rely on the leaders of Muslim countries, leading Muslim clerics, teachers in Muslim countries, parents in Muslim countries, to push back on that message, and that's why it's so difficult.
Yeah. Well, just we'll talk more as we go along. We have a newscast coming up in just a minute or so. But how is the Obama administration dealing with the threat from ISIS, in your opinion?
So I think you have to look at it in a couple different ways. One is to say that when I was deputy director of the Central Intelligence Agency, and my job was to discover, find out the terrorists who exist today and who are planning to kill us. and to remove them from the battlefield, working with our partners in the United States government and working with our partners around the world. And there wasn't a single time that we went to the president and asked him for permission to do something to protect the United States where he said no. He was always extremely supportive of whatever it took to deal with these guys. So that's one thing I want to say right off the bat. The other thing I'd say is that we have a strategy in Iraq to deal with ISIS, and we have a strategy in Syria to deal with ISIS. I am very confident that the strategy in Iraq will ultimately be successful in pushing ISIS out of Iraq. If you look at the territory that they took during their blitzkrieg a year and a half ago, they've now lost, Joy, about 25% of that territory.
Let me stop you there. Because we have news, we'll pick up after we check news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. We are talking with the former CIA Deputy Director, Michael Morell, author of the new book, The Great War of Our Time, The CIA's Fight Against Terrorism from Al-Qaeda to ISIS. We welcome your questions for him and your views on the threat that exists and how it got to be this way and how the U.S. is handling this threat. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Well, just before news, Michael Morell, you were talking about the threat from ISIS, and it seems to me you said we're fighting ISIS on at least two fronts in Iraq, where you thought you were confident that ISIS could be defeated, but we didn't get to Syria. Right. Are you as confident there?
No, not at all. And I think we've got a solid strategy in Iraq, which is a mixture of air power and ground troops. And as I said, we are slowly taking back territory, and I am confident that over time that we will take all of that territory back. But just as I am confident in Iraq, I lack confidence regarding our strategy in Syria. Our strategy in Syria is essentially to train the moderate opposition and equip them with weapons, and send them back in and have them fight ISIS and then Assad. The problem with that strategy is that the president ordered it over a year ago, and we are just now in the initial stages of training the moderate opposition, and we don't have plans even, Joy, to train the moderate opposition in the numbers that it's going to take to defeat ISIS. So what I think is going to happen over time is we will have a hammer in Iraq, but we won't have an anvil in Syria. And what we're going to do is we're going to push ISIS out of Iraq and into Syria, where they will have a safe haven in eastern Syria. And if they have that safe haven, and if they feel comfortable there, they will slowly develop the capability to reach out and attack us, just like Al-Qaeda did in Afghanistan prior to 9/11.
Mm-hmm. So what can we do about this?
So I think we need to take another look at our strategy in Syria. And Joy, this is really, really tough. I don't have the answer. It's not like I'm sitting here saying I know exactly what we should do. Syria is one of the hardest policy problems that I've ever seen in my time in government. And one of the reasons it's the hardest policy problem, just to give your readers, your listeners a sense, is that there are multiple wars going on there, and they actually point in different directions in terms of what the United States should do. So one war, right, is this war between, proxy war between Iran and Saudi Arabia, and that's one war that's taking place in Syria. And in that war, we should be supporting, in my view, Saudi Arabia. But the other war that's taking place there is between a secular leader, Assad, and Al-Qaeda and ISIS. Who should we support in that war? obviously the secular leaders. So we've got two different wars going on that point in two completely different directions in terms of what the United States should do. And that's why this is so tough.
Yeah. You know, some have suggested that the U.S. needs to put boots on the ground to properly combat this, including Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, who's been talking tough on terror as he unofficially runs for president. He says the country needs a president who will stand up to global enemies and call radical Islamic terrorism a threat to us all, and hinted, or at least said, that he wouldn't rule out boots on the ground. First off, your reaction to that.
So I believe that to push ISIS back in Syria and to ultimately defeat them there, we do need boots on the ground. We need somebody's boots on the ground. They don't necessarily have to be U.S. boots on the ground, but we need somebody's boots on the ground. You cannot win a war with just air power. That's point number one. Point number two is the reason you need Western boots on the ground, and again, they don't necessarily have to be the U.S., but they could be the U.S., is you need to have boots on the ground with those opposition fighters that you're training. And the reason you need Western boots on the ground with those folks is for two reasons. Number one, to make sure that they are carrying out their operations with as much strategic and tactical efficiency as possible. And number two, to make sure that they don't do something that they shouldn't do, like walk into an Alawite village and kill a bunch of women and children. Right, so that's why it's very, very important to be with them for both of those reasons. But I agree 100% that at the end of the day, we need somebody's boots on the ground if we're going to defeat these guys.
A listener on Facebook comments, moving to a broader question here, many people have accused the CIA of actually creating the terrorism they claim to be fighting. It is easy to find, fund, and motivate terrorists, as the CIA well knows, but we are usually expected to call these terrorists freedom fighters. It can be indirect as well. For example, support is given to the Saudis, who in turn support ISIS. What's your reaction to the CIA has actually created this terrorism threat that we are currently fighting?
Yeah, so a whole bunch of reactions. First of all, let me be very, very clear. There is absolutely no evidence that Saudi Arabia has provided any support to ISIS. Saudi Arabia is one of our most important allies in the region. To the comment about, you know, do CIA... U.S. government, let me put it that way, U.S. government counterterrorism operations actually create more terrorists? The answer is absolutely they do. We don't know how many, but they absolutely do. But here's the choice you face, Joy. When you have individuals who you know are plotting to carry out attacks against the United States and who are plotting to kill American citizens, and you know that they have that capability, you have to deal with them. You have to deal with them in some way. And it is absolutely true that when you deal with them by either capturing them or killing them, that you do radicalize additional people. But what choice do you have when you know those people are trying to kill you? Let me give you a metaphor. If somebody's trying to break in your home and kill your family, you have to deal with that person. You can't worry about the people outside of the house, the other gang members perhaps outside of the house, and what their reaction is going to be to how you deal with protecting your family. So it's a very tough issue. One of the most important things I talk about in the book, and I think this goes to your listener's question, one of the most important things I talk about in the book is we cannot capture and kill our way out of this. We certainly have to protect ourselves, and we need to continue to do that. But to ultimately win this war, we have to stop the creation of new terrorists. We have to stop the radicalization process. And there's a whole bunch of things I talk about in the book about how we need to go about doing that and how our allies need to go about doing that. And I talk about one country in particular, Indonesia, that has actually done a remarkable job in this regard. So in a sense, I agree 100% with your listener, but I would just say that at the end of the day, we do have to protect ourselves, even if that means creating some additional terrorists along the way.
Let's go to Ron in Manitowoc. Hello, Ron.
Thanks. Audrey Cronin, in the March issue of Foreign Affairs, makes a statement, quote, ISIS came into being thanks to the 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq, end of quote. Your take on that statement?
Yeah, so let me just talk a little bit. It's a great question. Let me just talk a little bit about where ISIS came from, and there are a lot of factors behind the rise of ISIS. It's absolutely true that al-Qaeda in Iraq, which was the predecessor to ISIS, came into being to fight the U.S., what was perceived and, you know, what was in reality the U.S. occupation of Iraq after the war. One of the main factors was less the invasion and more the decision to disband the Iraqi army and the Iraqi security forces. And when those folks didn't have a job anymore, when those folks didn't get a paycheck anymore, they joined the insurgency. They joined al-Qaeda. And that was the first big boost to al-Qaeda in Iraq. But I'll tell you, by the time the United States military left Iraq at the end of 2011, al-Qaeda in Iraq was at its weakest point. And when we left, it started to rebound, and it rebounded for two reasons. One was the military and intelligence pressure that was put on al-Qaeda in Iraq went way down because the U.S. wasn't there to help Iraq anymore. And two, al-Qaeda in Iraq had a huge boost from the political decisions on the part of former Prime Minister Maliki, who made a whole bunch of decisions that disenfranchised Sunnis. So you had a whole bunch of moderate Sunnis joining al-Qaeda in Iraq. And then you had al-Qaeda in Iraq go across the border into Syria to start fighting the Syrian civil war against Assad, and that's when they changed their name to ISIS. And they grew exponentially in Syria because they got their hands on weapons, they got their hands on recruits, and they got their hands on money. And they became a very powerful organization, and they eventually went back to Iraq and did a blitzkrieg across Iraq and grabbed all that territory. So the story of how ISIS got to where it is actually a very long one and very complicated. And yes, U.S. policy decisions played into that in a variety of ways, but so did the Arab Spring and the behavior of Prime Minister Maliki.
I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with Michael Morrell. He is the author of The Great War of Our Time, The CIA's Fight Against Terrorism from Al-Qaeda to ISIS. Michael Morrell, former CIA Deputy Director. We welcome your questions for him at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let's take a call from James in Elkhorn. Hello, James.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. You know, this may be the war of our time, but as like just a guy with a family and a business in Southeast Wisconsin, it doesn't seem like we are a nation at war. And I look around, and for many of my peers and people in this town, business as usual, and I wonder if that's a problem. Should we be feeling like a nation at war, and if so, what should we do to be more invested or at least informed, or what do we do about that?
Michael Morrell?
That's a great question. When you walk into the Counterterrorism Center at the Central Intelligence Agency, there's a sign, and I talk about this in the book, and the sign is a picture of the World Trade Center towers on 9/11, and on top of that photograph are words that say, "Today is September 12th, 2001." And those counterterrorism officers walk by that sign every day, and that's how they think about where we are. That's their sense of mission. That's how strongly they feel about the threat. But I have to tell you, when I used to get in my car and drive away from Langley, it increasingly began to feel like September 10th, 2001. It began to feel like the nation was forgetting about what happened on 9/11. So I do think that it is very important, and this is one of the reasons I wrote the book, is I wanted people to understand that the threat still exists. It hasn't gone away. It didn't die with bin Laden at Abbottabad. It's very important that Americans remember. I was in an airport security line a couple of weeks ago, and people were complaining about having to stand in line, to stand in a security line, complaining about having to take their shoes off. That's all a reflection of, you know, being 14 years away now from 9/11, and it's very, very important that we remember that there's a threat, and that we act accordingly.
You know, I think as James mentioned, we don't necessarily think of Wisconsin as a state that's going to be some sort of target of terrorism. What do you have to say about potential attacks, possibly inside Wisconsin's borders?
So when you think about, it's a great question. When you think about Al-Qaeda or even an ISIS-directed attack in the United States. So when they plan and they choose the operatives and they fund the operation and they send the operatives, you know, in a 9/11 kind of way, those attacks are probably going to be in New York, Washington, Los Angeles, big cities, big targets, symbols of the United States of America. I think that places like Wisconsin have to worry about the lone wolf attack. Places like Wisconsin have to worry about those young men and women who are being radicalized by the ISIS message, radicalized by the Al-Qaeda message, those people who may be in your very community, who in their bedrooms and in their basements are being radicalized, and who might go out with an AK-47 and walk into a mall on a Saturday afternoon and try to kill as many people as possible. You know, we had one of the Al-Qaeda-associated groups, Al-Shabaab, a couple months ago actually call on their followers to call on extremists to go into malls and to kill people. So that's the kind of thing I think that people in a place like Wisconsin have to worry about.
Yeah. I wanted to get you to comment on the news this week about the raid that ended in the death of Osama bin Laden. NBC News reported that multiple sources claim that the officials in the Pakistani government knew where he was hiding the whole time. You said that this is completely irrelevant. Why doesn't it matter?
Well, it's not that it's irrelevant, Joy. It's that it's wrong. It is absolutely wrong. This is the Seymour Hersh article in the London Review of Books, which NBC picked up on, and NBC is now walking away from the story. What Seymour Hersh said is a couple things. One is that the Pakistanis actually had him under house arrest there. Number two, that it was a Pakistani official who walked in to our embassy in Pakistan and for $25 million told us where Osama bin Laden was. And number three, that Pakistan knew that we were going to fly into Pakistan that day and conduct the raid against bin Laden. All of that is completely false. I was in every meeting at the CIA. I was in every meeting at the White House with regards to this operation. And I can tell you with absolute certainty, and we have a whole chapter in the book on this that's quite fascinating. I can tell you with absolute certainty that we found Osama bin Laden not because a Pakistani walked into our embassy and told us where he was, but because we painstakingly identified one of bin Laden's couriers, found out where he was, followed him to the compound in Abbottabad, watched that compound in Abbottabad, and made the judgment that Osama bin Laden was there.
Michael Morrell is our guest. He is a 33-year Central Intelligence Agency veteran. He served as deputy director of the CIA from 2010 to 2013. He is the author of The Great War of Our Time, the CIA's fight against terrorism from Al-Qaeda to ISIS. And we'll continue taking your questions for him after we check the latest news.
This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with Michael Morrell. He is former CIA deputy director from 2010 to 2013. He is the author of the book, The Great War of Our Time, The CIA's Fight Against Terrorism from Al-Qaeda to ISIS, which was released just this week. Talking with him about the threat of terrorism, talking with him about some of the CIA's top successes and failures of the past 20 years or so in the fight against terrorism, and talking about what we need to do to prevent another 9/11-style attack or an attack on the homeland. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Michael Morrell, we just finished talking about the killing of Osama bin Laden. Who is in charge of Al-Qaeda now, and are they a group we need to worry about as much as ISIS?
So the leader of Al-Qaeda today is named Ayman Zawahiri. He was bin Laden's deputy for a very, very, very long time. He does not have bin Laden's charisma. He is a fairly effective manager, but simply doesn't have that charisma. He leads an organization that is centered in the tribal areas of Pakistan, that border area between Afghanistan and Pakistan. But there are a number of groups around the world that have pledged allegiance to him. ISIS is not one of those, but there's a number of groups. And I think one of the really important points that people need to walk away with, and one of the things I try to get across in the book is as dangerous as ISIS is today, some of those other Al-Qaeda groups are actually more dangerous. And as we focus on ISIS, we can't lose focus on these other groups, the ones in Yemen, the ones in Somalia, the ones in other parts of Africa. We got to keep our eye on both of them and continue to work against both.
Boy, we have so much more that I wanted to talk with you about, and running short on time. Let's talk about some other current issues. Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is supposed to testify on Benghazi in the near future. How do you feel about Republicans' continued efforts to investigate Benghazi and any sort of cover-up?
So I think people have sort of missed the big picture here on Benghazi, Joy. And there's a couple. The first for me is Benghazi was the first manifestation of the Arab Spring-induced spread of al-Qaeda's ideology. You know, on September 10th, they were at one place on the planet. Now they are across a huge geographic area from West Africa to North Africa to East Africa to the Middle East, still in South Asia, and in India and Bangladesh. So they've spread dramatically. That's been their great victory since 9/11, and a big chunk of that was due to the Arab Spring, and I think Benghazi was the first manifestation of that. The second point is Benghazi's not going to be the only U.S. diplomatic post that comes under attack. There's going to be many more in that area that I talked about. And so the second point about Benghazi is that we have a responsibility as a government. We have a responsibility as a country to do everything we can to protect American diplomats, American intelligence officers, American servicemen who are serving overseas. And I think that's another point about Benghazi. I do believe that Benghazi has been politicized. And I do believe it's important to get all the facts out. That's why I'm supportive of the Benghazi committee in the House run by Trey Gowdy. You know, I want Trey to get all the facts, and I want him to put those facts out for the American people.
You know, emails after Benghazi showed that you were the one who took out references to al-Qaeda from the talking points that UN Ambassador Susan Rice delivered on the Sunday talk shows. You wrote that the lesson that you took from this experience was that the CIA should stay out of the talking points business.
Yeah,
talk about that.
Yeah, Joy, let me say a couple things. One is what you just said, that I took al-Qaeda out of the talking points, is not true.
Okay.
So there are a lot of facts, quote facts, put quotes around that. A lot of facts out there about Benghazi, about the talking points, that simply aren't true. People have said that about me. I didn't take al-Qaeda out. Somebody else at CIA did. And so one of the things I do in the book is I set the record straight on all of this stuff. Now, you are absolutely right that I said that CIA and the intelligence community should not be in the talking point business. And what I mean by that is our responsibility is to the president, to his national security team, and to the Congress. That's who we should be writing for. We should not be writing for the American people. That is not our expertise. What we should do when the administration or Congress, in this case, Congress asks for those talking points, we should have them write the talking points, and we should check them for accuracy, and we should check them to make sure that there's nothing secret going out the door. But we're not public relations experts. We shouldn't be in the talking point business.
Yeah, another issue that you write about in the book that's making news since the book came out is that, and I hope I've got this right, you apologize to former Secretary of State Colin Powell for the intelligence that was the basis of his weapons of mass destruction speech at the UN in the lead up to the second Gulf War. Why did you apologize to...
Yeah, let me say a couple of things. Yeah, Joy, thank you for asking this. I spent a whole chapter on this in the book. One of the myths out there is that hardliners in the Bush administration pushed the intelligence community to say that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction. That's just not true. We believed that. We believed it before President Bush ever came to office. We were saying that during the Clinton administration, so nobody had to push us there. And we were wrong. I believe this is the greatest intelligence failure in the history of the agency. And I was in the chain of command at the time, so I take responsibility for that. But the reason I apologize to the secretary is because this is a man with an incredible professional career, an incredible public servant, just an outstanding patriot, and he put his reputation on the line. He put his reputation for probity on the line when he went out and gave that speech. And we armed him with something that wasn't true at the end of the day. You know, it wasn't on purpose. We just got it wrong. And it's tarnished. It's tarnished his career somewhat. You know, I've heard him say that this is going to be on his tombstone, right? The guy who went to the UN and said Saddam had weapons of mass destruction. So I thought it really important to apologize publicly to the secretary. I sent him that chapter ahead of time. He called me, and he was deeply appreciative of the apology.
Yeah. One other issue in the news: the U.S. House of Representatives voted to rein in NSA's bulk collection of phone records, while also agreeing to renew a provision of the Patriot Act allowing the NSA to collect U.S. phone and business records with a more limited scope. Wisconsin U.S. Representative Jim Sensenbrenner is the primary sponsor of the bill that passed yesterday. Let me just get you to react generally. What powers should the NSA have when it comes to this, and why are they necessary?
Yeah. So this is an important program. This fills one of the gaps that existed prior to 9/11. And I believe, I don't want to overstate this, but I believe if this program had been in place prior to 9/11, we might have seen some of the communications between the 9/11 hijackers in the United States. So it's an important program. But privacy and civil liberties are absolutely critical, too. So I was on President Obama's review group on this very question. And our recommendation to the president, which he accepted, was that NSA not be allowed to hold this data, that somebody else hold it, some private entity hold it, whether it's a single private entity or whether it's the phone companies, but that NSA still be allowed to query it for the purposes that I just talked about, to find out if there are terrorists in the United States talking to each other, But also have NSA have to get a court order every time they want to query that data. Those were our recommendations to the president. He accepted them. That's in the Sensenbrenner bill. I'm supportive of the bill. I think it both protects security and privacy and civil liberties at the same time.
Yeah. Now, for something very light, producer Bill Martins wants to know who comes up with the code names. He said in the secret meetings in the lead up to the Bin Laden raid were coded the Mickey Mouse meetings. Where do those names come from?
People need a code name, and they just kind of sit back and think of something that they want to use. So it's there's no science to it. It's just people's imaginations to come up with these code names.
Yeah. We have just a minute to go. What is the takeaway for our listeners of the Great War of our time?
I think there's two. One is about the war, and the other is about the CIA. The takeaway on the war is we're going to be facing this challenge for a long time. There are many things we have to do to get our arms around this. We're doing some very well. There's others we need to start doing in a better way. The book talks about all of that. The part about the agency is, I believe, Joy, there are many myths about the agency. One is this James Bond myth that we are perfect. There isn't a secret we can't find, a plot we can't stop. That's nonsense. There's also a myth, Joy, that we are Maxwell Smart and we get everything wrong. That's a myth. The reality is that we are an organization of incredibly dedicated people working very hard to protect the country, and that we get many, many things right. But like any organization, we get some things wrong. Those are the two takeaways.
Thank you very much for being with us.
Great to be with you.
Michael Morell is the author of The Great War of Our Time, The CIA's Fight Against Terrorism from Al-Qaeda to ISIS. Thanks to Bill Martins, to Christy Taylor, and to Caleb Lado for producing and directing this hour. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. The Week in Review is coming up next. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.